two yesterday had just looked at the forms for houtos and ekenos, the Greek demonstrative adjectives. And looking at the paradigms, just noted some features about those. The syntax on section 103, there's two, well, there's several sub-points here, but the three major points we need to consider is, first, houtos and ekenos never modify anarthrous nouns. They never modify anarthrous nouns. Now, that doesn't mean they're not used with anarthrous nouns, but when they are, they're pronouns, and they're not modifying those nouns. We'll see that a little bit later on. But they never modify anarthrous nouns. And secondly, they never occur at either of the attributive positions. So that's unusual. Of course, an adjective is frequently, you know, normally associated with an attributive position, but houtos and ekenos only occur in the predicate positions, and when they do, their meaning is pretty much an attributive meaning. So either first predicate position or second predicate position. So houtos holaos, for example, would mean this people, and the second predicate position holaos houtos means this people also. But you won't see it in an attributive position. Okay. He also lists the fact that they can function as pronouns. This is just kind of an extension of the idea of making a substantive out of an adjective. The demonstrative adjective can also be a substantive, and when it is, it's functioning like a pronoun. This one, that one, these ones, etc. And I don't think we need to say too much about that. Then on page 84, part C here, when houtos and ekenos do occur with anarthrous nouns, they are not modifiers of these nouns, but pronouns. So you may see houtos or ekenos with an anarthrous noun, but when you do, it will not be modifying the noun. It will be a pronoun, and it'll function pretty much in a predicate position, a real predicate position. Usually there'll be a form of the verb to be, though. So, for example, ekenos kleptes esten kai leistes. That man is a thief and a robber. So that man, see, ekenos is being translated as that man or that one. And then that one is a thief. Rather than saying ekenos kleptes, ekenos is not modifying kleptes directly. It's not saying that thief. It's saying that man, that one, is a thief. In order to say that thief, okay, you would have to have ekenos ho kleptes. You'd have to have the article there and have a regular predicate position. Yes, Eric.
Take a translation there. That the bones are over. I wanted the word bones. So
no, that's kind of because of the word kai and the way kai is used. It's a possibility that that thief is also a robber. Is a possibility just because of the way that kai is translated. We haven't really. We're going to come to a chapter here pretty soon with. In fact, we just got to that chapter with coordinating conjunctions at the end of last year, and really haven't gotten that far in it yet. But we'll look at the use of the word kai, and this is only because there's a possibility there because of the syntax and structure of that sentence that it could go that way as well. But he says not that thief is also a robber. I see what you're saying now. As far as the also is concerned, that's a possibility with kai, but the part that's not possible is to say that thief. Because that thief would be taking a kanos and making it attributive to thief. So that doesn't work. Okay? But if that worked, then the translation also for kai would not be a problem. Everybody get the roll sheet? Okay. Then the last few comments. Comment D about houtos and ekenos connected to a predicate nominative by an equative verb. When that happens, it'll normally have gender and number and case, just like predicate constructions do. And so that's nothing unusual, except that there's an exception. Tut esten is a very consistently used phrase, and it's almost an idiomatic phrase. And it will not necessarily agree. It's just going to be neuter all the time. In spite of what thing it's referring to. But it's almost an idiom, so it kind of stands by itself. Then you can have houtos may also be used with autos, as in egrapsa tuto auto, I wrote this very thing, and then you get this using autos in the same way as you saw it before with the thing itself or the very thing when you find it in predicate position. So that's just kind of a combination of things you've already learned. And houtos and ekenos may also modify nouns which are modified by other adjectives. So houtos and ekenos can be a part of a string of adjectives on a noun. And gives some examples of that as well. So it's not that you can only have hutos or akenos and no other adjectives. You can have other ones on there too. But hutos and akenos will always have predicate positions, either first or second predicate position. And the other adjectives will have attributive positions. Okay, then chapter 15, to kind of follow on to that, is personal pronouns and related adjectives. The personal pronouns are words, of course, that take the place of other proper nouns. And the first of those is autos, and that's what you use to cover your third-person pronouns, third-person singular and plural. So third-person would be he, she, or it, and in the plurals, of course, it would be they, them, etc. And it's going to be used in various cases. The autos is going to have, you know, you might see it in the genitive, you might see it in the nominative, you might see it in the dative or the accusative, any of the four cases. And so section 105 says, the case of the pronoun autos is always the same as that which would be required of a noun with the same syntactic function. In other words, to decide what case it is, you have to say, how's it functioning in the sentence? And if the noun were really there, the noun that this pronoun is standing in place for, it would have to have a certain case, and so the pronoun is going to have the same case, and it's governed by its position in the sentence. So nominative case form of autos may function as the subject of a sentence, and we won't even bother to read the examples here. It's pretty straightforward. The second category, accusative case form, may function as direct object. Yes, Glenn?
Something that's not example under number 113. The other ones, you know, masculine for a male person, a feminine for a female person, and a neuter for something that's not.
Yes, that's inanimate.
Autoi is masculine, but they have no root.
Right.
You know, non-human subject.
Sure.
I would expect it
out top. Okay. Well, it doesn't always work that way, because what actually happens is that the relative pronoun is going to have a gender that's going to agree with the noun that it's taking the place of. If it's an inanimate object, it may be neuter, and you'll especially see the neuter if you don't even know for sure what the thing is that it's referring to. If it's kind of indefinite and you're not really sure, then you'll see a neuter. But if there's a noun in the context that's been used, and say that noun is masculine or say it's feminine, the relative pronoun will agree with it, but you won't translate it she or he, you'll translate it it. In other words, for example, if it's logos, the word logos is a masculine noun. And so if you see autos further on referring back to logos, it's going to be masculine in form. But it doesn't mean he, it means it. It's referring back to logos. That's what happens in John 1, by the way. And of course, Trinitarians who see a person in the logos, they're going to translate it he. But there's no reason to. It just simply has to be masculine to agree with the noun that it's referring back to. So here, when it says autoi, they have no root, it's probably referring back to a noun in the context that it was a masculine plural noun, and therefore they use a masculine plural form. If the noun happened to be feminine plural, they'd use a feminine form, and you'd still translate it, they have no root, and understand it not as masculine or feminine, but just as a referring to an inanimate object. That point will be brought up. Let's see. I think it's, 106. Yes, right. Yeah, that's the section. Section 106 brings up that whole point. It says, the gender of the Greek noun or the third person depends on the gender of the Greek noun to which it refers and not on the sex or sexlessness of the person or thing which the noun itself represents. Thus, autos and aute may correspond to English it, and auto may correspond to he or she. So you might have a neuter form sometimes when you're referring to he or she, because if it was one of these neuter nouns, for example, paidarion or something like that, then you might actually translate it he in English, because it's obviously referring to a little boy, but the Greek noun for little boy happens to be neuter. And so the pronoun would have a neuter form, even though you might translate it he or she in English. But far more common than that is the translation of it for something that is masculine or feminine, just because of the grammatical gender connection. Okay? As far as the rest of these examples here, point number 2, page 85, accusative case functions as direct object. That's pretty straightforward. Dative case functions as indirect object. The genitive case form of autos may be attributed to the noun. And that's one thing I'll call a little attention to on part number 4 here on page 86. And that is that there is an unusual feature here as far as autos is concerned. When it's in the genitive case, normal genitive phrases can occur in any of the four positions, the two attributive and the two predicate positions. But when it comes to this personal pronoun, it may occupy the first attributive position, but not the second, and either of the two predicate positions. So the second attributive position is something you'll never see autos as a relative pronoun, as a personal pronoun, used. And so you just eliminate that one. That one just doesn't occur. And the rest of them all have basically the same meaning. So you see examples of the first attributed, first predicate, and second predicate, but no second predicate, second attributed position. Okay, then a note at the bottom of the page here when it comes to expressing possession. The equivalent of an English possessive, his, her, its, their, with an anarthrous noun, is usually a Greek genitive of autos with an articular noun. Now that may sound as strange at first. An English with an anarthrous noun is coming out in the Greek with an articular noun. But it's really not as strange as it may appear, because in English, when you say his book or his word or something like this, what you're really saying, when you put a possessive pronoun form on it, it's making it definite. When you say his word, you're making it specific. And in effect, you put an article on it. And so in Greek, you're going to see this with an articular noun with autos. So for example, ho logo, ho autou logos, or autou ho logos, or ho logos autou, all means his word. And actually, you can think of it this way, and this helps me think of it, keep it straight. His word is the same as saying the word of him. The word of him. And the word, of course, you got the article on it. So it does make sense. The word of him is the same as saying his word. And so I think that makes it, will help clarify it. And then he gives examples with feminine and plural here, too, the same thing. Now suppose you want to say a word of his. Suppose your concept is indefinite, and you want to convey that. That's also possible, and you can use the anarthrous form of the noun with autos and genitive form of autos, and come up with, for example, logos autou would be a word of his, whereas ho logos autou would be his word, the word of his, the word of him, or something like that. So that can be done. You're probably not going to see that very often, though. It's not too often in language that you're trying to talk about an indefinite term that has a possession associated with it. But it could conceivably occur. And there is a way to do it then. Okay, then this next section, 106, is what we just discussed. The fact that the pronoun is going to be having a gender form that's going to agree with the thing that it's representing and not necessarily having any implications toward masculine, real masculinity or femininity in terms of the sex distinctions. Okay. You see a couple of examples here. Maybe just call your attention to a couple of them. In that James 5:18, the second example, hey, gay, eblastisen ton karpon autes, the earth brought forth its fruit. We're translating its fruit because it's referring to earth, and earth is an inanimate object. And even though it's feminine here, it's being translated as it, because it's an object, it's not a person. And then in Luke 1:59, a couple of examples further down, ekalun auto Zacharias, they called him Zacharias. Well, the auto there is neuter, and you might say they called it Zacharias, you know, but usually we think of it as a human being, so we would rather not call it an it. But the thing is, it's referring to paideon, meaning child, which is neuter. And so that's the reason why the auto was used there, even though in English we might translate it him. Okay, so that I think is pretty straightforward. Section 107, these are the paradigms of the first and second persons. Now, autos is the third person form. And now we have the first and second person forms of the personal pronoun. And you probably recall these. The paradigms are a little bit different than the other paradigms we've learned. We've got ego, and then we've got emu and mu, two optional genitive forms, emoi and moi, and eme and me. And the same with su, and then the genitive su and su, with one with the accent, one without, soy and soy, one with the accent, one without, and set, one with the accent, one without. The ones without the accent are called enclitics, and they kind of borrow the accent from the word they're associated with. And he doesn't give any real strong rules for the difference between the two, but basically the ones with the accented forms in general carry a little more emphasis. That's about the major distinction. And then within certain combinations or certain specific uses, you will see the accented forms used more than the unaccented and vice versa. So it's not all that important for our purposes, since we're not really composing Greek, but when it comes to translating it and so forth, you won't really have any problem discerning between these. And then your plural forms, of course. The main thing there is the paradigm is just the same, except you got hemes and humes. And if you learn one, you've learned them both. You just change the eta to an epsilon, you've got it. But just make sure you remember which one's which. Okay. And the same syntactic characteristics apply to these as due to autos. They're going to, except you don't have gender distinctions there in the first and second persons. It's just I or we and you or you plural, and there's no distinction between masculine and feminine for these pronouns, whereas there is with autos. Yes?
Omega is the last one. I was looking at ego and I never thought about it. I thought that should be a circumflex.
Well, let's see. It is on the ultima, and the ultima can have either the acute or the circumflex if it's on the ultima. The rule you're thinking of, I think, applies to the second to last syllable, and it has to, if it's going to have an accent, it's got to be a circumflex or something. I think that's the thing you're referring to. You can double check back there and see what the there's no rule that prevents you from having this. It's just, you see, those rules had to do with the last syllable being long or short and the accent that could be on the syllable before the last syllable. So there's nothing problematical about this. The long ultimate, it may itself either have the circumflex or acute. Yeah. So, yeah, that last rule on page 319 would cover that. Okay. But you don't know how to predict what it'll be. You know, you just have to kind of take it for what it is. In other words, if you heard the word ego, and you heard it, you wouldn't know whether to put a circumflex or an acute on it unless you'd seen it in print. Okay. He mentions a little bit about the enclitics there in section 108. Then section 109 just covers the basic functions. I don't think we'll go through this, but just showing them as nominative and accusative and dative and genitive. The same thing, though, happens with a genitive on these first person and second person forms as happened with autos. They don't occur in the second attributive position, only in the other three positions. Second attributive, they don't occur in. So it's about the main thing to note there. It's about the only thing unusual. I don't know if I want to take time to look at the rest of these points. Mostly these are just minor points. This point G here on page 90, the emphatic form mu is not used to modify nouns except when it's joined to another pronoun, usually by chi. So normally you're going to see the shorter form when it's used to modify nouns. It's just a matter of quick speech, I guess, more than anything else. But if it's joined by chi to another pronoun, then you'll often see the emphatic form, because the word's kind of set apart that way anyway. Possessive adjectives was an area that I think people had a little trouble with last time when we went through it, especially on the tests. And basically what you're looking at is a different way to say the same thing. In other words, they've got personal pronouns, but then in addition to the personal pronouns, there are also these possessive adjectives that function just like any other adjective. The pronoun functions like a pronoun, and these function like an adjective, and they are declined just like any other adjective. So you have things like emos with eta and on. That's just like kalos or any other adjective you've seen before, except it means my. So you want to say my book or something like this, you see, you can just put, or my word, you know, hello, ho logos emos or something, ho emos logos, etc. Ho logos, ho emos. You can just use, your normal positions and Inflectionally and syntactically are similar to other adjectives. They occur much less frequently than the genitive forms of the personal pronouns. If you want to say my with the personal pronoun, you should put a genitive form of the personal pronoun. Or you can use one of these possessive adjectives. So the possessive adjective is in a sense equivalent to the genitive form of the pronoun. But it's used less frequently and perhaps carries a little bit more emphasis because of that. So you can see examples here of the use of these. They just decline like any other adjective. So you've got emos and sos, and then hemeteros and humeteros for your plurals. And all they mean is mine, yours, or ours, or yours, plural. So they've all got a possessive meaning. They've all got meaning like the genitive does, but they're going to just adjust their case and gender and so forth to the noun that they're attached to. Okay, any questions about that, Greg?
What I was wondering, and I'm figuring that these will then agree with the noun in number and gender, even if the person himself, like if I'm speaking, say, my toys,
right.
I would actually use a plural.
Yes, exactly.
If the toys are feminine, I actually use feminine.
Right.
Now.
Right. Precisely. Yeah, that noun is going to go with that adjective is going to be governed by the noun that it's attached to and not by the person that is being described. That's a good point. So that may seem a little strange at first, but it's just think of it in terms of this adjective. The adjective has its own meaning, and that meaning is my, but its forms are going to agree with the noun it's attached to, and that noun may be feminine plural, but it's still my, and you may be masculine. So that's a good point. That's a good point. Okay, anyone else? Okay. You see an example here, even in the substantive use down here on bottom page 91, part C. Ta emma panta sa esten kai ta sa emma. All that is mine is thine, and thine is mine, so forth. Well, this is neuter plural. All that is mine, neuter plural. But he's talking about things that are his, and he's not certainly not neuter nor plural. But he's substantivizing this concept, talking about the things that belong to him. So the things are neuter and the things are plural, but they belong to him. So that's where the adjective meaning comes in. Okay, anyone else with a question on that? You don't see those real frequently, but just, you know, you do need to know what you're looking at when you do see them. All right, this next chapter is dealing with a concept of present and imperfect indicative passive. Beginning to deal with this concept of a passive verb form, and I won't even take too much time with this other than to just show that he's starting out trying to show what happens when you transform an active sentence to a passive sentence, first in English, then in Greek. And the basic situation is that what's happening, suppose you've got an active sentence, like you've got some examples here, cats catch mice, and want to convert it to a passive. What you do is you take the thing that was started out as your subject and make that, let me start it this way. You take the thing that was your direct object and you shift that over into the subject position. You convert the verb form from an active form to a passive form. Then you take the thing that was your subject originally and put that into a prepositional phrase of agency, indicating the agent. And so cats catch mice could be converted to mice are caught by cats. And here you find the mice now that was the direct object in the first sentence is now the subject of the new sentence. The verb form is converted from an active form to a passive form. Passive form is one is a verb that indicates that the subject is the one who receives the action. And then to indicate the performer of the action, you use a prepositional phrase, by, and then have cats in this case as the subject of that. So that's the basic sequence. Now the same thing occurs in Greek, except that the way that we designate what subject and object in Greek is different. And word order is not a requirement here. So in Greek, what we're going to do is we're going to take the thing that was in the subject position in our original sentence and put that into a genitive form with the preposition hupo to indicate our agent. Take the thing that was in the object position, which was formerly in the accusative case, and shift that to the nominative case, make that the subject. So we're going to change the thing that was accusative into the nominative case, and then convert our verb form from an active form to a passive form. So it's the same philosophy that is happening with English, except that it's not word order now that's determining the positions, but case function. So you can see there at, if you compare on page 95, section 118, we have a little sentence alpha here and then a little sentence beta there, this diagram. We have X in the nominative, verb active, and Y in the accusative case. So we've got two nouns, one in the nominative, one in the accusative. So that's your simple structure, noun, verb, and object. And the passive transform of that would be Y now in the nominative case. The thing that was once your accusative, your direct object, now is in the nominative case, and it's functioning as a subject. The verb's in the passive voice. And then you have the preposition hupo, which is used for indicating direct agency, plus the noun now in the genitive case. And so, because hupo takes the genitive. Rob?
Is there any reason why you couldn't have your nominative that was changed to a genitive with hupo at the front of the sentence?
No, there wouldn't be any reason. You could have that right out in the front. You could say hupo, etc., and then and the word order will be variable. Of course, hupo does have to go right in front of that genitive form. You know, you couldn't put hupo around different places. But these three units, if you consider these three units, they could occur in any order. That's right. So that's the reason why they use the designation of genitive and nominative and use the case and so forth to specify these things. But the order can be variable. It's just that you've got to preserve the transformations of the cases. So at the bottom, you see this little diagram that kind of shows you the arrows and what thing goes to what. The noun, the X sub N here, the noun X that was in the nominative case to start with gets shifted over to the position of the genitive. It doesn't have to come at the end of the sentence, though, as Rob said. It could come in the beginning and so forth. But this is just probably, you know, trying to take the English convention just to kind of show you parallels. The verb that was in the active voice becomes passive, and the noun that was in the accusative case, your direct object, now becomes the subject and it's in the nominative case. So that's probably a good little diagram. You can summarize this whole chapter by that diagram in the bottom of page 95. If you've got that, you pretty well have it as far as what's going on. Now the only remaining task is, well, there's several tasks. First, you have to know the cases, the various, you know, nouns and how to change one from a nominative to a genitive and vice versa. So we're assuming you know that. And then the next problem is to convert a verb from an active to a passive form. And so in the next section, section 119, he kind of gives again an inductive study where he's showing you in boldface type here what these passive forms are, and then in the exercises and so forth, you end up drawing paradigms for those. So I won't get into that too much right now, because when we put these all together in the next few chapters, we'll have a whole paradigm for these forms. And it would be probably worth your while to get out your paradigm charts and just be reviewing and looking at the various verb forms and how to, you know, convert active to passive and so forth. Well, no, not necessarily, but it'd be a good idea to look it over anyway. We may, I won't give you any formal tests without giving you an announcement on it, but we may do some exercises in class along with like the ones we did before. So it wouldn't hurt you to brush up a little bit. Okay. So that's about it as far as this chapter is concerned. Basically, the concept of converting from active to passive, and then looking at, as far as the present is concerned, at the present and imperfect, really, at the passive verb forms. And basically, with the present passive, you just have a different set of endings. Omai, etai, you know, that paradigm rather than just your simple omega conjugation. So you're just putting a different set of endings on it. The same base, same stem, so forth, but just a different set of endings. And then, of course, as we proceed, we'll find other things in addition to the endings that are going to be different, and different sets of endings. Okay, that brings us to the chapter 17, dealing with the middle voice, and this is something that's a little different. It's not that English doesn't have anything like this. It does, but English middle voice ideas are usually transmitted by the meaning of a particular verb and the way it's used, and by certain auxiliary verbs and so forth that are associated with it. Whereas in Greek, we find a separate form for that. Now, in an active sentence, the subject performs the action. In a passive sentence, the subject receives the action. So in a middle sentence, it's kind of a combination of the two. Somehow the subject is performing an action, but also receiving in some way the benefit of that action. It may be a direct reflexive, where he's doing something to himself. That's a direct reflexive sense of the middle voice. Or it may be that he's actually doing something to someone else, but he's also doing it for his own interest, for his own benefit, or something of this nature, where the action's effects are going to be upon him as well. And it may not be as direct, but it still may be appropriate to put it in the middle voice. So he's first looking at English sentences here, and some of these model sentences he's given in the past, and focusing, for example, on this idea that Professor bathed here at the bottom of section 122, page 99 here, as an example of a middle voice, and because of the idea of the verb itself, and and the meaning of it. But then in section 123, he goes on to say that in Greek, there's a paradigmatic way to designate what's a middle voice. You're not having to rely just on the meaning of a particular verb like you do in English so often. And so we find here three examples on page 100, at the top of the page, examples A, B, and C, to illustrate the difference. He adelphe elusen to technon, the sister bathed the child. There you have an active verb and a subject performing the action and a direct object receiving the action. So that's the standard type of sentence we're familiar with. Then we have he adelphe elusato, and there's a middle voice form, and this is transmitting the information that the sister bathed. She bathed, or she bathed herself. In other words, she took a bath herself. She performed the action, but she was also the recipient of the benefit of the action. And there's a middle voice sense. And then, example C, to technon eluthe hypotes adelphes. There's your passive construction, where now the child was bathed by the sister, and the sister is the performer of the action, but it's designated by hypo plus the genitive, and child is the one who's receiving the action, but it's a passive verb form, so it, child will be the subject in the nominative case. Yes, Rob?
Is that going on eluthato? Is it a misprint there, or am I missing something?
Are you referring to the omicron upsilon there?
Yes.
Elusato? No, it's a different verb than luo. See, as you're thinking of luo to loose, there's luo, el...
there's two luo. I was looking at that elusa.
Okay.
The last sentence of that paragraph on 100 before you get
ABC. Oh, yes, okay, yeah. Yeah, you notice... Note that the verb in each sentence is luo, not luo, okay? So, it's this luo, not this luo, and that's why this. So there's no spelling error. This is just a different verb. Although there may be some relationship between the meaning of the verbs, you know, to loose and to cleanse, those ideas of cleansing, getting loosening the dirt off and so forth, there may be some connections, but they are technically different verbs. Okay? But they're both in the same category as far as their paradigms are concerned, and they both end in a vowel sound, and so they're very, very nice regular verbs. Okay. So he just goes on here to talk a little bit more about this middle voice form, and there to have a middle voice in Greek does not necessarily imply that there's no direct object. You may have a direct object in the sentence, even with a middle voice verb form. In this example, you don't have. The sister bathed, as she did it to herself, you see. But you may have a direct object, and in those circumstances, you'll know that it's not a direct reflexive, but somehow the action is being performed, and somebody's receiving the action, but the one who's performing the action is also involved in the receiving of the action. So those are kind of interesting uses. Those are the ones that are, I think, especially important to pay attention to when you see them. And when you might have expected a passive verb form or an active verb form, and you got a middle verb form, that's something worth noting. Okay, the forms now, as far as the middle voice, we'll get back to the meanings of it at the end of the chapter here. But, Tony, do you have anything else on that first?
Quick question. If you wanted to use, in some way, put the middle voice in that first sentence,
mm-hmm.
what would you do that? First of all, would you just change the verb to little boy?
Right. Yeah, you just use a middle.
How would you translate it?
Okay, the translation then. Yeah, if in that first sentence the sister bathed child. If you've used a middle voice form there instead of, and you can make a clear distinction in the past tenses now, because the middle forms in the aorist, in the aorist and so forth are different than the simple active forms and so forth. But anyway, if you did that and you had a middle voice there, then you do get into some problems in trying to translate it in English. You'd have to say something like the sister bathed the child for herself or for, you know, her own benefit or something like this. In other words, try to convey that. It's sometimes awkward to do that. But the fact that they use a middle voice would show that the sister was not doing it purely for the child's benefit, but also for her own benefit. And this is why Concordant, for example, will have a symbol to show that it's middle voice, because it's very often awkward in English to try to convey that idea. We're not used to doing that. So that's why in sermons and so forth, sometimes you have to say it's middle voice, just to transmit some information that is awkward to use in translation in English. So that's what it would be. Okay, section 124 deals with the forms for the middle voice. And the forms of the first aorist middle are given below to facilitate comparison and contrast. The forms of the first aorist active and first aorist passive are also given. Although we really haven't talked too much about the passive, that's going to come down in the next couple sections. But there's the paradigm for the active, middle, and passive, and you can see that your middle voice endings for the aorist are also having this thematic alpha. You have amen, amen, o, ato, amatha, asta, anto for the middle forms. And so they're somewhat analogous to the endings that you see on the, omen, a, eto, omatha, esta, onto, the ones that you had for the passive for the present. So it's just kind of shifting from a thematic omicron to a thematic alpha for these middle voice forms. Now, in the present, there's no distinction between middle and passive forms. You have middle and passive as the same form. In the aorist, there is a distinction between the two. You have a separate set of middle forms and a separate set of passive forms. The passive forms, you can see here, have this thematic eta, eluthane, eluthase. You get this theta in there, and most of them, although some of these second aorists don't have it. But you have always this eta-type paradigm. There's an eta in all of the endings. That's a real good indicator, a real quick indicator that you're looking at an aorist passive form. Okay, then he makes a note of what the endings are for the middle, and these are added to the third principal part, your aorist base. So there's nothing too much. If you know the aorist active form, you can find the aorist middle forms with no problem. They're going to be a kind of a slave to what the active forms do. Just a different set of endings is all. So whatever the active forms do, if you've got an irregular first aorist in the active, it'll be an irregular first aorist in the middle. The same base change and so forth will be there, but the endings will be the same. And here he gives us some examples of, luo, elusa, elusamein, grapho, egrapsa, egrapsamein, etc. That's pretty straightforward. Now, section 126 deals with aorist passives. And he says the aorist passive forms are not derived from any of the bases studied so far. In fact, the aorist passive is its own principal part. It's the sixth principal part. And there isn't any way to predict whether the aorist passive is going to be regular or irregular, even if you know what the aorist active does or the aorist middle does. The passive won't necessarily follow suit with it. Sometimes you'll have an irregular aorist in the active, and it'll be perfectly regular in the aorist passive, and sometimes vice versa. So they kind of have to be learned separately. One nice thing about the aorist passive, though, is that the ending system is always going to be the same. You're going to have these endings, eta nu, eta, sigma, eta, amen, eta, and aton. Those are consistent, and they're the same for first aorist passive and second aorist passive. Now, this is a little different than your aorist active and middle, because the aorist active and middle forms will have different endings for the second aorist. They'll go back to the imperfect type endings for their second aorist, whereas the second aorist passives will still have the same endings. What will be the difference? Do you remember what the difference between an aorist passive, second aorist passive and a first aorist passive is? No theta, right. The second aorist passives don't have a theta. That's the thing that sets them apart. Now, there may also be some suppletion or some other change in the stem, but the thing that really identifies it as being second aorist and not an irregular first aorist, for example, is the fact that there's no theta. And that'll be mentioned a little bit further on down here. Okay, so to form the aorist passive, you find that sixth principal part and drop off the eight anew and put whatever ending is appropriate according to this ending system. Okay, then he gives some examples at the top of the next page of aorist passives from certain verbs that we're familiar with. But there's another feature here that we need to take note of. It's analogous to what we had before when we were trying to put sigmas onto things. And that is that when you add the theta for the aorist passive forms on those that are the first aorist forms, there are going to be these same kinds of phonological changes that will occur. When you stick a theta onto a P, beta, or phi, or P, tau, the result is a phi theta. If you stick a theta onto a kappa, gamma, chi, or double sigma, the result is chi theta. And if you stick a theta onto a delta theta or zeta, it's going to be sigma theta. So those are the same, and in fact, it's the same categorizations, although the result is a little bit different as what we saw before. It says, there is no way of telling, however, whether the aorist passive forms of a constant verb base of constant base verbs, or even all verbs whose bases end in vowels will be regular. Even the ones that end in vowels you can't be certain about as far as the second aorist is concerned and the aorist passive is concerned. So here he gives us a list of some irregular first aorist passives. And see, akuo you might have expected to be real straightforward. But it gets akustein, you get a sigma in there that you didn't expect to get there. And sozo becomes sothane, you lose the zeta completely. Hurisco becomes hurethane. And we did make a note here, I think you might have noted that it was an error here, hurethane, it's not hurethane, but it's hurethane. There's an epsilon there rather than an eta. And if you look at it in the back of your book, you'll see that. So I think it was just a typographical error. Sometimes there'll be alternate forms too, so that might be a possibility here. Then section 129, verbs which have second aorist active forms also have second aorist middle forms, but need not have second aorist passive forms. So we've already pretty much talked about this. There won't necessarily be a predictable situation there. And section 130 talks about those second aorist passives, and here's a few examples of ones that are second aorist passive, which you might not have expected. Grapho, for example, you would probably have expected agraphane with the phi staying there, but it's agraphane, no theta. And I mean, the phi stays there, but the theta doesn't appear. So that's a second aorist passive. But the ending is the same, eta nu, so there's no problem there. Philibo is ethlibane, no theta. Copto is ecopane, no theta, and the tau drops off. And crupto is ecrubane, and the p tau becomes beta, and there's no theta. So these are the kinds of things that, you know, are kind of aggravating, I suppose, in a way. I mean, it'd be nice to have everything to be regular, but at least your ending system hasn't changed, so that's something to rejoice in. Okay, so that's about all to say on that. It's just a matter of sorting it out and reviewing it for yourself and reviewing your endings and your paradigms just to make sure that you got it all together in this respect. The meaning of the middle voice, though, here is, again, something we'll just take a quick review of. He breaks this down into three categories of kinds of meaning for the middle voice. The first category is a direct reflexive, where you're actually doing something to yourself. The subject is both the performer and the receiver of the action. And he says it's probably the least common meaning of the middle voice. Probably you don't see that kind of thing too often in terms of the amount of time, although it's something that's pretty easy to relate to in English because we do have reflexive verb forms in English. Then you have the middle voice may express an indirect reflexive meaning. Indirect reflexive is what we often term this idea of self-interest, doing something for your own for your self-interest, where you're actually performing an action on someone else, something else, or someone else is receiving the action, but you're doing it also for your own interest. Maybe not exclusively for your own interest, but your own interest is definitely involved. So the middle voice may express an indirect reflexive meaning, that is, the subject of a verb in the middle voice may indicate both the performer and performer of the action and that to or for which the action is performed. It's almost as though it's functioning as both the performer and the indirect object. Remember, indirect objects show an interest and so forth. So I think that may be a fair analogy, at least, to think of the indirect reflexive as an example in which The subject is the performer of the action and the indirect object of the action. And then you have something else that's the direct object of the action. At least that's the kind of a category of association I think that would be safe to make on this. Since the indirect object idea is pretty broad anyway, it'll pretty much cover this. Then, thirdly, the middle voice may express a causative meaning. That is, the subject of the verb in the middle voice may indicate the person who causes or allows an action to be performed. So that's another use for it, because the subject may not be the actual performer of the action, but the subject may be the one who is allowing the action or authorizing the action or causing the action to be performed somehow. And so you kind of get this mixed idea of the one who's involved here as the subject is maybe not doing the entire action, but he's certainly required for the performance of the action. Bob?
Is that also in a causative meaning? Does it necessitate that it be for self-interest, or?
Well, no, maybe not necessarily. Not necessarily for self-interest, although usually it will be just by as a matter of course. If somebody causes something or allows something, their will, their volition is involved, and they've made a decision to have it. So I suppose that you probably couldn't find an example otherwise, but I think the real reason that the middle voice is used there is that there is a joint participation, you might say, between the person who is allowing the action and the action itself. He's involved in it, but he's not directly involved. So you kind of get this mixed idea, and that's very typical of the middle.
Mm-hmm. Crosses my mind in that situation. I don't know how it would be used to say it, but say a child trying something that is just maybe capable of parent allowing that.
Right.
It's not necessarily for the parent's benefit, it's for the child's benefit.
Right. Right. In that situation, you may have a different construction. You may have a verb for allowing or something and just go ahead and put it that way, where you didn't want to necessarily make a connection with the person who is allowing the action to be performed. It kind of depends on what you're really trying to say in a situation like that. You could either go with a middle voice form, which would show the parent's involvement to some extent, or you could use a completely different vocabulary word, a different verb for allowing, and then that would kind of separate that and put it into a mode that's very similar to English in that respect. So it all kind of depends on what's trying to be said and what is trying to be expressed. Yes, Greg?
You're talking about scripture. Like, I know it's not the Hebrew, but they, or I know it's not the Greek, but where Pharaoh's heart was marked.
Yes.
Pharaoh's heart.
Uh-huh. You might very well do that. Of course, Hebrew doesn't have the same kind of thing, but if it did, it might be appropriate to see just this kind of a thing where Pharaoh hardened his, or God hardened Pharaoh's heart. You get kind of a mix there. When you put the full revelation together, you see that it's both Pharaoh and God involved in different aspects of it. So it probably has to be worded a little bit differently, but that kind of thing could be done with a middle voice form. Yeah, it would be. It'd be interesting to see how Septuagint related some of those things. But sometimes they'll just do it, they'll try to get those meanings just from the context and so forth rather than using forms, especially if they're a little bit in doubt and want to try to play it safe. But it'd be interesting to check and see. So in this chart here, in these examples, you'll see active voice, middle voice, passive voice, examples with the same verb anointed here. And you can kind of maybe use this as just a quick reference sometimes. If you're wanting to remember exactly the distinctions, you can quickly look at this chart and see them delineated for you pretty well. Active voice, I anointed him, or I anointed your head. Middle voice, I anointed myself. That would be a direct reflexive, to do something to yourself. I had myself, or let myself be anointed. That would be causative. You didn't actually do the anointing, but you submitted to it and allowed it, and your volition was required for the performance of the action, and so that would be used, a middle voice can be used for that. Or I anointed my head. That would be indirect reflexive. It's not direct because you're not anointing yourself really in the full sense, but you're anointing part of you, and so you're doing the anointing upon your head and you're receiving benefit for it, and head would be the direct object. See, in that sentence you have a stated direct object. I anointed my head, and my head would be in the accusative case here. And the verb though would be in the middle voice because you have this kind of indirect reflexive idea. And that's something to maybe note as a means of telling when you're dealing with an indirect reflexive. Normally, in an indirect reflexive, you're going to have a direct object in the sentence. And when you've got a direct object and have a middle voice with a direct object, you're seeing an indirect reflexive idea. Or perhaps one of these causative ideas, too, may get involved. Is that the first or second? That's first, though. Okay. Then I had my head anointed, or let my head be anointed. There again would be the causative idea, only this time with a separate tinkethylene here in the accusative case. And then the passive voice, I was anointed by my disciple or something, if you wanted to add an agent. One thing about a passive sentence, you don't necessarily need to state the agent. In fact, that's sometimes the reasons for using a passive construction. If you know an action was performed but you don't know who did it, you can put it in the passive, you know, and still express the idea that somebody received an action, but even if you didn't know who did it. But then here, of course, you can also add the agent and make that more specific. So I was anointed, passive verb form. Okay. So that is an important chapter as far as getting this basic meaning and distinction. And right now I'm not so worried about the detailed forms. You can go through and pick those things up, and those will come back all right. But the main thing is trying to remember the structure and the significance of these ideas of voice and later, of course, mood and so forth in Greek, that they're a little bit different in some respects than English. Active and passive are pretty straightforward, basically the same in Greek as in English. But the idea of middle voice is something that's deserving of more attention. And we'll be giving it more attention during the course of this year, too, when we are doing translating and we see middle voice forms that are unambiguously so. We're going to be asking questions, why middle in this case, and applying some of these general understandings to more specific cases. Well, chapter 18 then. Any other questions here on 17 first? Okay, chapter 18 just completes the paradigms for the verbs now, as far as what we're dealing with at the present time, and that's dealing with the future, middle, and passive. And these forms don't occur very frequently, so that's why they're kind of put here at the end. And then deponent verbs in the verb aimi. He just gives the paradigm just out and out right here in section 134 for the future, middle, and future passive forms. And again, in the future, you do have a distinction between the middle and the active and passive forms. And so we find the future middle is formed by just taking the base, that future base that we already learned about, taking the present base plus putting a sigma on, and then just adding omai, a, etai, omata, esta, ontai, same endings you added on to the present to form the present passive, middle and passive forms. The future passive, you'll notice that the endings are just the same, omai, a, etai, omata, esta, ontai, same set of endings. However, the base is different. Now you've got a theta, eta, sigma stuck onto the lu, you know, lu theis. And that's one way to think of it, but there is a more general way to think of what that future passive base is. And actually, in order to get it right all the time, you need to recognize that it's based on the sixth principal part, just like the aorist passive. And so what you'll do in general to form your future passive is to find the sixth principal part and chop off the Ada nu, or chop off the nu, I guess is all you really need to do, because there's an Ada on there. Chop the nu off, put a sigma on, and then add your endings. So that's the way in general to form your future passive. Future passive and aorist passive kind of think of as having the same base. And that's the only way to be consistent on it, because you see, there will be, if you've got a second aorist passive, there will be no theta. And so there will be no theta in the future also. Some of you may have noted, I can't remember which books that they are now. There's some books that talk about a second future, and you know, in their terminology. What they're referring to is these, in the future passive being built on the a second aorist. See, the aorist passive having a second aorist passive, meaning no theta. And so the future passive is going to have the same peculiarity. So you could call it a second future, you know, just like you call it a second aorist. So if you see that terminology, that's what it's referring to. So the future passive is kind of a slave to the aorist passive. The future middle is kind of a slave to just the normal future form and just adding this set of endings. And the future passive and future middle are both using the same ending set. So that's really all we need to say about this. Section 136 gives you the details now as far as... I should have mentioned you have to remove the augment from the aorist passive base too, because the augment is indicating past tense and you don't have that in the future. So you chop the augment off, you drop off the new, you put a sigma on, and then you add your endings. And that'll give you your future passive forms. Okay, deponent verbs. Well, it's a good place to stop, I suppose. Let your minds digest that and think about that. You might want to, now that we've looked at most of these verb forms, you may just want to look at your paradigms and try to remember again how to form each of these various sets. and we'll probably do a little bit of exercise on that. These next few chapters are going to go fairly quickly. This chapter 19 I'm not even going to spend time with, because it's just kind of a summarization of this morpheme system. And then we're getting into third declension. So we're on the home stretch here. Okay. No, there normally won't be. You mean when you add the Thedon? Yeah, they'll be the same as they were for the Eris. Exactly the same situation. And see, that's kind of taken care of if you use the six principal parts. That phonological change will already be done. So that's the reason why they didn't put any emphasis on it. But it is the same situation.